Hush, 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 here comes the boogeyman. Don't let him come too close to you, he'll catch you if he can.
Welcome to Boggart and the Banshee, a supernatural podcast. I'm Chris, the relentlessly informative. I study ghosts, Fortiana, fashion history, and death.
And I'm Simon, Chris's worst nightmare. I study boggarts, fairies, urban legends, and the impossible.
Chris, so good to be with you again. What's your recent news?
Well, I've been letting a nearly finished book stew a bit before its final edit, and I've been transcribing some 200 absolutely bonkers supernatural tales from an anonymous writer of the late 19th century, as one does.
200.
Yeah, it's wearing. It's a lot of theosophical blather combined with gory details of the American Gothic. So we'll see if I can hold out.
Do you think that's something you'll publish in the end, or is this just for a general interest?
No, I think it will eventually be published. I'm not sure the world is ready for it yet, though.
So what about today? What have you got in store for us?
Well, today we're going to be talking about the miniature coffins and their doll corpses that were discovered in 1836 on Arthur's Seat in Edinburgh.
I came fresh to this topic just a couple of weeks ago when you announced it, and I'm sure many of our listeners will now be as confused as I first was. So can you give us an idea?
This is one of the original reports of the discovery from the Scotsman in 1836. It's called A Strange Discovery. About 3 weeks ago, while a number of boys were amusing themselves in searching the rabbit burrows on the northeast range of Arthur's Seat, they noticed in a very rugged and secluded spot a small opening in one of the rocks, the peculiar appearance of which attracted their attention. The mouth of this little cave was closed by three thin pieces of slate stone, rudely cut at the upper ends into a conical form, and so placed as to protect the interior from the effects of the weather. The boys, having removed these tiny slates, discovered an aperture about 12 inches square, in which were lodged 17 Lilliputian coffins, forming two tiers of 8 each, and one on a third just begun. Each of the coffins contained a miniature figure of the human form cut out in wood, the faces in particular being pretty well executed. They were dressed from head to foot in cotton clothes and decently laid out with mimic representation of all the funeral trappings which usually form the last habiliments of the dead. The coffins are about 3 or 4 inches in length, regularly shaped and cut out from a single piece of wood, with the exception of the lids, which are nailed down with wire sprigs or common brass pins. The lids and sides of each are profusely studded with ornaments formed of small pieces of tin and inserted in the wood with great care and regularity. Another remarkable circumstance is that many years must have elapsed since the first interment took place in this mysterious sepulchre, and it is also evident that the depositions must have been made singly and at considerable intervals, facts indicated by the rotten and decayed state of the first tier of coffins and their wooden mummies, the wrapping clothes being in some instances entirely moldered away, while others show various degrees of decomposition, and the coffin last placed with its shrouded tenant are as clean and fresh as if only a few days had elapsed since their entombment.
I found a couple of references to this as fairy coffins. There are lots, though, of other explanations. Could you give us just a quick, brief overview before we plunge in?
The primary thought was that these were the remnants or the memorials to the victims of Burke and Hare. They're sometimes called body snatchers, but they were just common murderers who sold the bodies of their victims. And it caused quite a stir in Edinburgh. So it was thought that perhaps they had 17 victims. These were 17 coffins, although there's been dispute about the number of Burke and Hare victims. That's the primary one. There were also suggestions that they were memorials to sailors lost at sea. And it's also been suggested that they were memorials for some revolutionaries in 1820.
Well, before we get to these theories, Chris, perhaps we could set the scene a little bit more with the place. We're talking specifically about Arthur's Seat, which is this very impressive mount just on the edge of Edinburgh. And in fact, already in the 19th century, urban development in the city had gone around the edge of this mount. I can't think off the top of my head of any other city which is so closely linked to such an impressive bit of landscape right next to the city. I can think of other cities that are in a valley with hills around, but here you have this very, very dramatic crag that rears up above the city. If you want a place then for a little bit of supernatural drama, Arthur's Seat is the perfect place for a finding of this kind.
It's also a place for murder. There were several notorious murders committed and suicides as well at the spot. 1720, a surgeon murdered his wife because he was tired of her. And in March of this year, a man was convicted of pushing his pregnant wife off a 50-foot cliff on it.
Oh, my God.
So it's not, it's got a dark history to it as well.
I think this is something that we came across about 10 episodes ago when we did Boggart Hole Clough near Manchester. Boggart Hole Clough was this natural park near the city. And one of the consequences of being next to an urban development with 500,000 or 1 million or more people is that, yes, it's a lovely place to visit on Saturday afternoon and to take your family, have a picnic. But of course, it also is a place where darker things, like you say, take place. And it becomes, to some extent, a focus in the same way that Boggart Hole Clough became a natural place that people go off and try and commit suicide, where people would take drugs and have overdoses. And so there's always this double side with a place like this close to an important urban center.
I wonder how populated is it? Is it like a park where people walk a lot and there's a lot of traffic, or is it more isolated?
It's the kind of place that if you went on a sunny weekend afternoon, you'd meet lots and lots of people, you can imagine. But of course, the climate isn't always that great in Edinburgh. And so when you get to November or after dark, it becomes a very bleak place. And I think even on the sunniest of days, it has a rather unforgiving and severe aspect, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Again, that very word crag, I think, should give us an idea.
Yes.
A lot of rock in the place.
And obviously there was some kind of a small hole in this rock where these coffins were discovered.
My understanding is it wasn't really a cave.
No, it was just more or less a hole in a rock. It was about 12 inches square.
In a sense, whoever created this space did so by putting a roof on top of it. These bits of slate that we read about had been put over the top of these three natural shelves. Is that correct?
That's not what I would interpret it as. I would interpret it as a cavity excavated or natural that you go directly into. So there's stone naturally above it, and the slates were put up just to cover the opening.
Ah, okay. So when the person brought these coffins there, he or she could actually have gone inside this space, this overhang.
No, I think it was too small. They would take the slates down, put in the coffin, and put the slates back. There was no entrance.
So let's get to this business of the coffins. I mean, where to begin, Chris? I think you should take us away and I'll just ask questions as we go along.
Oh, I will be relentlessly informative. I have to start with the caveat. I have not personally examined these coffins or dolls. I'm working from photographs and from information from the National Museum of Scotland. The report on the coffins by Samuel Menefee and Alan Simpson, an American and a Scottish scholar, and an essay by Mike Dash. So let's start with the dolls. It's been suggested they're a set of toy soldiers. Now, there's very few surviving wooden soldiers from this period, so it would be very difficult to confirm or dispute this. I've looked at what I can see, and there's only a few that seem to be available. To my eye, they look like folk art rather than a commercial product, a toy soldier where uniformity was the norm. The Germans, who were the primary makers of these things, were meticulous about matched sets. And around this period, you would find plenty of German wooden toys in the country. If we look at the soldiers from a decade or so later, they generally have solid rather than split legs. They have movable arms and they have carved uniforms and hats. They also always stand on circular bases. Now, if these are soldiers, where are the cross belts? Where are the hats? It would be extremely unusual for a wooden soldier of this inexpensive and possibly homemade type to be dressed in a real uniform. The only 18th and early 19th century dress soldiers that survive are very expensive automatons. Usually they're French. And what regiment did they represent? Scottish soldiers in the late 18th, early 19th century would wear anything from a kilt to breeches to trousers or trews. Now, I'm not a doll expert, but I've had an interest in antique dolls since I was a child, and I've looked at a lot of them. These dolls have very unusual, almost unique, flat yet wide eyes and very strong facial definition. The facial definition is extremely unusual. Most 18th and early 19th century wooden dolls, they were sometimes called penny woodens or Dutch dolls, were the most common at this period. They have either round or oval faces with absolutely no cheek or jaw definition. The closest I can come to these dolls, and it's only in the resemblance of the eyes, are some dollhouse dolls from a 1730s house at Uppock, and those in a room assemblage at the V&A, which were made circa 1715, 1725. And even those aren't even that close.
So First of all, when you talk about wooden soldiers, that would presuppose that someone had created mini coffins and then repurposed soldiers to go in the coffins. That would be the idea.
I think so. That you would have a set lying around somewhere or that you had access to, and you said, okay, I need to use these figures for whatever purpose. Now I'll make the coffins.
Okay. My second question, you've talked about looking over the photographs. For me, this has been the single most exciting thing I've done for this episode. I read a lot around the subject, but it was actually when I started to stare at these objects that they really took hold of me, because they are very eerie to look at. Maybe yes. It's the association with the coffins. And you've talked now about the strongness of their faces. I see the faces of being of different individuals. I don't see them as being particularly similar. They have the same style and they're likely by the same person, but they seem to me to be different people. I know, though, that others don't agree with that. What's your take there?
I don't know if they're meant to represent individuals, but I agree they are not identical. They may be by the same hand, but it seemed to me to be some sort of homemade whittling of the features that just suggests these were not commercial products. If they were commercial products, they would be much more uniform.
And of course, this matters, because if someone had actually carved individuals, then it helps us perhaps to understand what the logic was behind this bizarre deposition.
That may not be the crucial point as I get into the clothing.
So let's go on to the clothing.
Several of the little figures are dressed in what look like onesies. They're sewn and glued onto the bodies. And I wondered if they were wearing what are called skeleton suits. But these were usually only worn by little boys, and they had tops that buttoned to the bottoms, and we don't see any buttons on these outfits. They're also wearing what appear to be high stocks or collars or neckcloths worn in the 1820s and 1830s. Menefee and Simpson consulted textile experts who said the cotton fabrics and threads used to sew them are from the 1830s. And looking at sample books from the 1820s and 1830s of fabrics, this seems very plausible. They're not wearing burial clothing, although I've seen the suits called that. In the 1820s and 30s, it would have been more usual for a corpse to be dressed in a backless shroud, stockings, and a cap. Few people were buried in their ordinary clothing, but it was thought wasteful to bury wearable clothing. They also don't have a strip of cloth tying up their jaws, such as have been found in some 1830s excavated burials. And if these were burial suits, they'd be technically in violation of the Burying and Woolen Acts, because they're cotton.
Is it possible that whoever put these together was most interested in the coffins and the dolls, and then just put some ragtag material, whatever was at hand, some rough textiles lying around, and did them as simply and easily as possible? And that these so-called clothes aren't really a reference to anything.
That's very possible. They're sort of slapdash. They talk in the original Scotsman report about how carefully the coffins were made with the pieces of tin inserted, but I find it all to be rather happy hands at home. It's sort of a do-it-yourself deposit.
For you, is that true of clothes, coffins, and dolls?
Yes.
Interesting.
I think that they are all homemade by an amateur, more or less an amateur.
Does it have to be one person, do you think? Can you see a similar style, I mean?
I do see a similar style. I don't think that these were made by more than one or two people. I don't think this was a group effort. I don't think there were multiple craftspersons involved. I think it was just all kind of done at home somewhere.
Because, of course, this is desperately important in as much as the report you read at the beginning implies that someone or a line of people has been leaving dolls over decades and decades,
right,
perhaps even generations.
Yes.
Because, of course, some of the dolls had already started to rot. And so the image we have is someone coming every 20 years and leaving a doll and then coming back, or maybe their son or daughter coming back a generation later to leave another doll. How would you deal with that logic?
That's the stuff of horror movies. This generational depositing of little coffins. No, the materials and the workmanship and the fabrics and the style of the coffins, they all say 1820s, 1830s. I don't think these were deposited over any length of time, perhaps just no more than a decade and probably less than that. Given the weather, you would think that the decay was normal on the lower level. They would get damp and they would just start to decay more readily.
So in other words, even if they were put in there all on the same day at the same time, some of them would actually have started to suffer from the elements earlier. Yeah,
I think so. Now, about the coffins themselves, they're not made in pieces like a real coffin would be. They're rather crudely carved, supposedly with a curved knife. They and the lids are set with tin bits meant to represent what's called coffin furniture. These are plaques, grip plates, and other ornaments attached to the coffin. There's a theory that the coffins and their dolls were made by a shoemaker because one of the shoemaker's tools is a curved knife and tin was used for shoe buckles. Well, I had a chat with Valentine Povinelli, the master of the shoemaking shop at Colonial Williamsburg in the United States. He was doubtful about the shoemaker idea, mostly because A, tin is quite brittle and it wasn't usually used for shoe buckles. And B, shoe buckles were not made by shoemakers. It was a separate trade. But by this date, tin was commonly used for coffin furniture. The pressing machines had made it easy to work into elaborate plaques. So if you're trying to duplicate a full-size coffin, tin would be the logical material for coffin furniture. And given that tin was used for cooking utensils, lamps, other household goods, scrap tin was not hard to find. What puzzles me is that although there are grip plates, the plates that went behind the handles, there are no handles. And even plain wooden coffins used by the parish for pauper burials had handles. These are clearly meant to represent coffins for a relatively affluent corpse. The more ornamentation, the more expensive. And I think of Nelson's coffin from 1806, which is encrusted with gilt plates, nail heads, handles, and ornaments. The poor were often merely shrouded and buried without coffins. So I've been obsessing about why no handles.
This means that the person who created these coffins was recreating the burial of someone who was not in the poorest part of society. And
yes,
coffins as we see them look very much like this. But still, anyone who had a coffin would have a handle. So there's the mystery of why these handles were missing. Could it just be a technical problem that it was difficult to attach something that would be convincing?
Possibly. But there are miniature coffin snuff boxes carved that have little handles. So it wasn't impossible, but perhaps it was beyond the scope of the person who made these. Or maybe they were just thought unnecessary since they were being deposited in a crypt rather than in lowered into the ground because
yes,
handles were used to lower them. But why go to all the trouble to add this coffin furniture but leave off the handles? And they look very like coffins that have been excavated in burial grounds at Suffolk and Golden Lane, London, which were dated between 1821 and 53. So we're again probably in the 1830s range. You mentioned that these were meant to be affluent burials. These were not the poorest people. I'm wondering, too, if possibly they were made for someone to honor them, give them the burial they couldn't have afforded in real life.
Interesting. So a couple of points that confused me about the burials. I'm going to focus on the figures, on the dolls. A number of the dolls are placed in the coffins without arms. The arms seem to have been there, but from what I can see in the photograph, the arms were wrenched off or removed in some way. Wouldn't that speak to the dolls having some kind of prior use? In other words, the dolls were used for something else, maybe toy soldiers, maybe some other game. And at a certain point, someone decided to put them in the coffins, made these rather homemade, rough and ready coffins, slightly miscalculated with the size or had the wrong size of wood to actually make the coffin with, and so removed the arms so they could fit in. How would you explain that? Would you agree that it means that the dolls had some purpose before the burial?
Oh, yes. And the arms could have been wrenched off by a child if they were playing with the dolls. I think they were repurposed, and it may be that they miscalculated the size of the coffin, or it may be that the arms were taken off for some more malevolent purpose.
Okay. We see in the photographs one of the figures with no arms in a coffin, and it does look like a quite tight fit. So for me, it was relatively convincing that it was a problem of size there, that the body didn't go in. Another question I have about the doll, Chris, is that some of the dolls, I think I'm right in saying, have some kind of hairline at the back, and the hairline just stops at the point there would be a hat. And some authors have suggested that this is proof that these were actually toy soldiers, that originally they had hats that had been wrenched off. Now, maybe these are homemade toy soldiers rather than machine-made or carefully made uniformed German toy soldiers, but toy soldiers nonetheless. Would you go along with that?
The tops of the heads seem to be curved as if they're part of the skull under the head. It doesn't look to me like anything's been taken off of any of the heads. As I said, I haven't looked at these in person, so I only working for photographs. There is a line across their forehead. And is that a hair line or is that a line of something that used to be there? As I said, these kinds of dolls would not necessarily have had clothing as soldiers. Toy soldiers almost invariably had carved uniforms and hats. That's one big feature of, they always have those tall hats.
I wonder if it would be useful here just to go through the points where you're quite certain, just so we get a sense of where the steady ground is and where the marshland is. First of all, there is no question that there are three parts. There is the doll, there is the coffin that I suppose is in two parts. There's the base and the lid that goes on top. And then there are the clothes, at least on some of the models where it doesn't seem to have rotted away. Secondly, you're also confident that these are figures that have been repurposed. In other words, that these figures predated the coffins. They've been put in the coffins afterwards. And that you also seem confident that if they weren't all deposited at the same time, they were deposited in a relatively short period of time. Would you agree with all that? Have I summed up your position?
Yes. Yes, I would.
Mm-hmm. Right. So at this point, I suppose we come to the question of what on earth is going on here? there's just nothing else like these finds. And again, I would implore anyone listening to this who is even 50% interested to go online and look for the photographs of the dolls. Because for me, when I actually started examining the photographs, it was then that I really became excited by these finds. They're just so unusual, like really nothing I've seen before.
Yes, they are completely unique.
My first instinct would be the following. If I were to come across in the countryside a coffin with a doll inside that had been secreted, I would assume that this was an act of black magic. That would be my first instinct.
Yeah.
We do have lots of records from British and indeed from Scots folklore where, let's say, the voodoo doll scenario, you create the model of someone and then you do things to that model that would spell pain, maiming, or even death for the doll. And a classic example, and I can think of two or three sources for this from Britain, at least one of which comes from Scotland, is you make a model of your enemy, and then with the normal hocus pocus, you put it in a stream. And the model, the doll, which is made out of wax or some other perishable substance, of course, slowly just disappears through the force of water.
There was a particular type of image in Scotland, and I cannot do the pronunciation, but it was made of clay. And yes, you put it in the water and it washed away, or you melted the wax.
So these make sense. But of course, here we're in a completely different realm, because these figures are made of wood, and wood does not disintegrate, at least on the kind of timescale that you would imagine a witch would want. I start to have problems with this being a series of voodoo dolls and acts of magic. And I'm particularly struck in the photographs that when I look at these figures, they have these broad, wide open almond eyes, very beautiful, very striking eyes, but very, very much alive. And it adds to the creepiness. But again, it's not quite what I would have expected, perhaps, from a voodoo doll.
Why would voodoo dolls have closed eyes? You wouldn't necessarily, you want them to suffer the pain. You're driving a nail into their chest. They're alive and they're writhing in pain, and you're enjoying that if you're the person who did it.
For me, the figure is put in a coffin. They should be dead in the coffin. But you're right, maybe part of the eeriness comes from the fact that they're alive in this closeted space.
Yeah, buried alive. That's another horror scenario. I find the witchcraft or black magic theory a very plausible one. I imagine some local wizard or cunning person periodically making a coffin or having a stock of them. And the individual outfits might suggest fabric taken from a specific person.
Oh, brilliant, Chris.
Or a client.
I hadn't thought of that. That would explain the difference in fabrics.
And it would be for a client who wished to ill wish someone. It was noted by Menifee Simpson and Dash that several of the dolls had their arms removed and the fabric was wrapped around the shoulder area. It wasn't even pretending to imitate sleeves, which suggests to me the fabric was the important item, as it would be if one was using malicious magic against the former wearer of that fabric.
Let's take a moment. This is all new for me, but I'm very excited by this idea that you're stealing fabric from someone. Maybe you're clipping the edge off a dress or something along these lines. And then this is really, really interesting.
Now, we have come across this before in the episode on late witches. There was a man who cut a piece off of a witch's dress, and he was going to use it to negate the bewitchment she was doing towards a local young lady. These dolls aren't really malice against someone, but they are meant to negate some sort of curse or charm.
But still, we're in the sphere of magic. We agree on this.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it would be the... Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Sure. Is it magic or counter magic? But it's
yes.
Magic.
Thank you. Thank you.
The example that I'm going to bring up here, just for any listeners who are tapping their fingers and impatient with this nonsense about witchcraft in the 1830s, there is an extraordinary archaeological dig from Cornwall from 2003, where an interesting archaeologist, this is Jackie Wood, had been doing some work on Neolithic remains in the area, and particularly in some marshland. And she came across, quite by accident, a rectangle in the ground that, of course, at first she associated with Neolithic remains, but where there had been a series of ritual objects placed within this rectangle. And she came back, and in 2003, she concentrated and looked for other of these ritual sites, and she found several. And what's absolutely extraordinary about these ritual sites is that carbon dating, gave us dates for these rectangles from the early mid 1600s up until the mid 20th century. I mean, it really is. It's one of these archaeological finds where I have problems actually believing what I'm reading on the page. But, well, what kind of things had been left? There were a number of stones, fool's gold, for instance, that had been ground up. There were eggs, including eggs that had very well-developed chicks that had been left there. There were also skins, but skins that were not just randomly found. There was a cat skin that still had whiskers and teeth. And for me anyway, very hauntingly, there was the skin of a swan with swan feathers. And these were objects that had been then left in these rectangles over the space of what, the best part of 300 years.
That's extraordinary.
Of course, it really is extraordinary. This is at Savioc, just outside Truro. And Jackie Wood said that she wondered whether this was connected to witchcraft. She wondered if it was local charms connected to St. Bridget and childbirth. I think she's guessing a lot. But anyone looking at these finds, if we can take them anything like face value, we have a magical tradition here going from the 1600s well into the 20th century. And it's just a reminder that in rural communities, there were people who carried out magical acts. And very possibly, if what you say is right, and I have rarely been as persuaded by your arguments as I am today with this business of textiles, maybe we've just stumbled on an example of this from Scotland. But let me come back to the awkward fact. Why in wood? Why not in a substance that would have rotted away in a satisfactory manner?
You're in a cavern, a small hole in the side of a stone. Maybe you could put wax in there and maybe it would melt. If you put clay in there, it's just going to sort of sit there. It's not going to decay. Wood does decay, and there are a surprising number of wooden witch and cursing dolls in local museums in the UK. Equally surprising is the lack of photographs of these items available on collection websites. I think they must think that the items are too potent even to risk posting them. You find images of such poppets at the Museum of Witchcraft and Magic in Cornwall. They're really unsettling. So I don't see wood as a negative when you're making a voodoo doll. Voodoo dolls in Africa are made of wood. So I don't see that as a particular negative for the theory that this is witchcraft. However, there's also a notion in folklore about transferring illness into a figure, or fooling death by burying a coffin, which is usually empty. In 1832, Edinburgh was hit by a massive cholera epidemic. Could these have been attempts to transfer the disease into dolls?
I suppose, Chris, I'm just thinking of ways that I can disagree with you here, just testing the waters. But I am really impressed, particularly about this business of textiles, which I think explains a couple of irregularities. I mean, another feature we have, I'm right in saying, I think, just 8 dolls left of the 17. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's all that survived. Yes.
I looked at these dolls very carefully, and I would personally, with one possible exception, have no doubt that they are all male. Would yes. you go along with that?
Absolutely. They made a real point of wrapping the legs and making sure they're looking like they're wearing male garments. If they were, as I said, burial clothes, they would have had a long shirt kind of shroud on. It would be, as one of the researchers has observed, it's just as easy to put a doll in a shift as it is to put them in a suit. So, yeah, I think they're all male.
Most attempts to explain what's going on here have suggested that there is some form of commemoration.
Yes.
You've already detailed a couple of these.
Right.
For instance, there's the idea that maybe there was some kind of disaster. 17 mm-hmm. people were killed, and someone who was not able to go to the funeral, or someone who perhaps the bodies were not recovered or were not in a fit state to be buried, at that point made this substitute burial. Alternatively, as you say, it's been connected to Burke and Hare and their dreadful deeds. And it is striking that there were 16 or 17 victims there. So what about the idea that this is commemoration?
Mike Dash suggested that the local papers be searched for disasters where 17 people were lost. I did a quick search and found a couple of shipwrecks, one in 1809 and the other in 1827, where 17 people were lost. But the big problem with the notion of proxy burial for people who were maybe lost at sea or lost in disasters, there seems to be no actual record of this practice. Folklorist Edward Lovett was quoted as saying, "In Scotland, Brittany, and many other places, when a fisherman or seaman is lost at sea and his body irrecoverable, a doll was placed in a small coffin and the funeral rites and ceremonies performed over them, after which the coffin and its contents were placed in a vault or grave." Trouble is, this is virtually a single source, and he gives no evidence or citations. And to be perfectly frank, he was really enthralled by dolls in and out of a magical context. His Wikipedia entry notes, "This theory has not been supported by recent scholarship."
Which is polite.
Yeah. The only actual memorial miniature coffin I've ever seen for a seafarer is that of Captain Cook, and it lacks a corpse, although it contains a lock of Cook's hair. It was created by one of the men on Cook's ship, the Resolution, during the return journey from Hawaii to Britain. It's in the State Library of New South Wales.
Huh.
Now, in the United States and Ireland, at least, there are plenty of tombstones carved with "lost at sea." There are monuments to lost fishermen in many towns in Scotland. One was dedicated in Fife in 2019. And I read a very poignant essay written by an author named Peter Neal, who visited a coastal village in Ireland and found a seaside graveyard with many graves marked "lost at sea." He said they all faced inland, away from the ocean that had claimed their lives. So I think the evidence, at least in the British Isles, suggests that there were other ways of commemorating the lost dead than burying tiny dolls in coffins.
I agree with this. And it also is worth saying that, of course, Edinburgh is not a coastal town. It's not a town with a strong tradition of people going to sea. I did come across this one quotation, and I'll just share this with you. This is from 1871, and it relates to the South Coast. We're in Devon here. "A number of workmen made a curious discovery on Saturday last." This is a newspaper article. "They were engaged in excavating on Mr. Weymouth's ground at the east end of Walden near Torquay, when they came upon a miniature coffin at a distance of about 6 feet beneath the surface."
Six feet.
So they took time over this. "The coffin is only 7 inches in length and consists of heart of oak. And judging from the appearance of the wood, it is of very great age. One of the sides was knocked out by one of the workmen with a pickaxe before it was discovered what it was." And here the article becomes, for me anyway, a bit confusing. "At the ends, there are handles in metal forming a lady's hand and cuff." So these are the handles I think you referred to.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah. "On the top, there are the letters PP in brass nails with a cross beneath." And that's all the information we have. And significantly, nothing is said about what's inside, which would lead me to suspect that there was nothing inside.
Yes, yes.
Now, this could be an example of some form of commemoration. The letters PP on top are suggestive. But of course, it could also be another act of sympathetic magic. It could be an attempt to curse PP, or it could be some act that we don't understand of counter magic here. So it's suggestive, but yet we come banging up again against this fact that there is no tradition of this from Britain or Ireland that either you or I have been able to track down.
Right. Yes. Now, there are certainly miniature memento mori coffins, which contain models of decomposing corpses or skeletons, and they're found primarily on the continent. I've also seen one or two 17th century miniature coffins that appear to contain effigies modeled on a specific individual. A good many of these come from Germany. And I wonder if these coffins were misunderstood as memorials to missing dead. Someone might see something like that and think, oh, that must be an actual specific memorial. Mr. Fraser, the jeweler who collected the surviving coffins, he thought the depositors were probably some of the French emigrants who accompanied the household of Charles X. When his Comte d'Artois, he resided at Holyrood Palace, about 1795 or 96. If that were the case, I would think more likely the French were seen just as aliens or Catholics, so anything unusual would be attributed to their work.
Of course, yeah. I would say that there's a reasonable case to be made that this is just a single act of creation from someone who was either mentally imbalanced or perhaps a little bit eccentric, or perhaps just absolutely standard issue, but with a strange kink in this area. And I'm always conscious of how in life, even the most normal of us, and I don't know if you or I would have pretensions to call ourselves normal in any way, but even the most normal people I meet usually have those couple of strange conditions. I've been reading recently about the famous Swiss psychologist Carl Jung. I was reading part of his biography. There's a moment in Jung's life where he suffers what reads very much like a series of psychotic breaks, perhaps even the beginning of schizophrenia. And Jung essentially cures himself by just living in his garden and sculpting stones, creating waterways in the garden, designing things in the earth and with water. He was obsessed with the way water runs around. Now, if some archaeologist were to come across some of these waterways or some of the strange sculptures that Jung created and had no context, it would be the easiest thing in the world to start talking about pagan ceremonies deep in apparently Protestant Switzerland. Mm. In other words, it's so easy for things to be taken out of context. I myself go for long walks through the woods near to my house, and I have a few, get this, Chris, secret cairns in the wood where I always leave a stone as I'm walking by. Now, again, when the historian in 200 years finds a pile of little red stones where there are no red stones in the wood, what will they make of that? And I just wonder if this was someone who was possibly someone with mental issues, but also possibly someone quite normal in every other respect, who had this rather strange hobby, and that for whatever reason, this hobby that was obviously a very private thing gave him or her great satisfaction.
You make a good point. They have a resemblance to outsider art, and I've certainly seen similar things in museums of folk art. Let me make a couple of other theories. As we said, many of the early discussions of the coffins describe them as fairy burials, referring to the diminutive size, and we can't see any actual relation to the good people. I don't know that there's an actual fairy tradition of this area, but they do remind me of the stocks that were sometimes found buried in the place of people exchanged for changelings. Then could they be artifacts of the Odd Fellows fraternal organization?
Oh, now this I'm looking forward to. I'm a longtime fan of the Odd Fellows, so tell us more.
Well, we know that they were, you know, like the Masons or other fraternal organizations. And we know that there was an Edinburgh Lodge, the Thistle Lodge, as early as 1815. Skeletons and corpses are used in the order's initiation rituals. And you can still find miniature coffins and their funereal items. People are still finding these skeletons in their coffins in their attics today. But I'm not sure whether Scottish Odd Fellows rituals actually use that imagery. It's said that to members, the skeleton is a symbol of mortality, a treasured relic used in one of their most solemn and secret rituals, initiation. So that's one theory. I agree with Menifee Simpson and Dash that since they're dressed as men, they do not represent Burke and Hare's victims because 12 of those were women. However, what if they represented corpses that were not illegally snatched? The Anatomy Act was passed in 1832. It licensed anatomy teachers and it gave enhanced legal access to unclaimed corpses from prisons or workhouses or hospitals. And at this point, overseers of work and poorhouses were allowed to sell the corpses of friendless inmates. They were eventually dissected and buried by the anatomy school. Win for the workhouse, win for the parish that didn't have to pay for burials. And dissection spiked right after 1835 as the supply of corpses increased, and there was a corresponding decline in burials at parish expense. What if an inmate of the workhouse, grieving his fellow inmates who died and were sent to the dissection room, created the coffins and dressed the figures out of the scraps they found just to give their friends a decent burial? Tradesmen in the workhouse might work at their trades, so materials like cloth, wood, and tin would have been readily available. And we've got the Edinburgh Charity Poorhouse on Forest Road. It's about 2.5 miles from Arthur's Seat. How much liberty to make the trek to hide tiny coffins a poorhouse inmate might have is doubtful, but we do know that they were sent out to make deliveries of goods like firewood. It's a stretch. I think witchcraft or counter-witchcraft is probably the more likely theory, but I did want to mention it.
Certainly, Edinburgh in this period had had this very unusual experience of Burke and Hare, of individuals actually being murdered so their bodies could be supplied to medical science. And then, as you say, the follow-on with legal dissections from bodies of people who died on the parish's books. I can imagine in that circumstance that whether your theory is correct or not, that there is a heightened awareness of burial.
As soon as the Anatomy Act was passed, there was an emphasis increasing in the middle class, for example, of having a decent burial. And that's when the undertaking trade really took off.
You described very well at the beginning of today's talk the shape of this, let's say, overhang or niche where these coffins were kept. The coffins were not actually buried. They were placed effectively within a crypt. Now, that in itself, you made something of that because of the lack of handles, that handles were particularly used for lowering into the ground, and here they were placed within a crypt. Is it possible that we should make something of that? There wasn't a hole somewhere where these coffins were put into and covered with earth. They were actually given this improvised crypt. That presumably is a high status burial.
That's a really interesting point, and I had not considered that. Why weren't they just buried? If you wanted them to decay quickly as a matter of witchcraft, you might have buried them. On the other hand, if you wanted to stretch out someone's torture, just have slow decay. But yeah, high status. That's interesting because the coffins duplicate that of a high status or middle, at least middle class status burial with all their ornaments on the coffin furniture decorations. So yeah, it's very possible that it was meant to provide something better than the person might have had in life.
And I think here it's worth, for the third or fourth time, say, please go and look at the photographs. Because if someone had described the coffin to me, I would have thought, yes, yes, this is something that has been just taken out with wood and someone's used, they've carved basically this coffin. But the lids have these incredible bits fixed onto them. And that presumably is very much a high status burial. They look like plaques to me that have gone on.
Those are coffin plaques, depositum. I think they're called depositum plaques if they're supposed to have the name on it. And I don't know if anyone has actually found any kind of engraving on those plaques. You know, we were talking about whether these could have been women. I thought initially I'd seen a special kind of coffin plaque, which was only used for women. It was a lozenge or a diamond shape, but they're not. They're coffin shaped or escutcheon type coffin plates.
So let's try and sum up a little bit. We've come up with a number of theories. We've come up with the commemoration theories, and there are different types of commemoration. We've talked, for example, about putative disaster at sea. We've talked about someone in the poorhouse wanting to commemorate those who died. I also mentioned the possibility that this may have just been an eccentric who, for whatever reason, got some thrill out of this act. And then we've also had the magic or counter magic theory. It seems to me that you've come down on the side of magic or counter magic. I didn't think I'd say this at the beginning of today, but on the basis of what you said, I would perhaps go along with that. For me, there is only one weakness left, and that is that apparently all these burials are male. Now, it's true that we only have 8 of the 17. And it's also true that if what you say about fabric is correct, then perhaps you could have used a woman's fabric and placed it next to one of these older wooden dolls. But I still find that a little bit concerning. I would have imagined there would also be women, perhaps not 50-50, but at least a fair number of women. What would you say to that final objection?
I would say that you might have a female magical practitioner and you have clients who have animus against their husbands who beat them and drink up their pay packets, and the weaker sex doesn't always have recourse by law, so we take matters into our own hands.
Okay, we finish with this lovely bit of misandry then. Look, we usually at the end talk about readings, but I think we can agree that there's very little to read here. However, there is this one excellent article, and it's, forgive any mispronunciation, Samuel Piatt Menefee and Alan D.C. Simpson, The Westport Murders and the Miniature Coffins from Arthur's Seat. And this is available online on our Facebook page, where there's often lively discussion of these matters. We'll put a link. And it appeared in the Book of the Old Edinburgh Club and is now available from their site as a PDF. I thought that this was an outstanding article. I learned a lot from it, and I think it got the right balance between theorizing but also giving concrete information. So whether you agree with the theory or not, there's lots of good material there to work with.
Yes, it is really an excellent article, and it summarizes all the details of the cloth and the coffins and the carvings, that sort of thing.
Well, with that, Chris, would you read us out with something? What have you got to round off today's episode?
Well, this is a bit of self-indulgence. This is something I've written because there is so little on the subject. So this is just, call this my whimsy. What battles they have seen, limbs lopped off, feet worn to nubs, clothing in tatters. Were they charnel house changelings? Friendless corpses sent to the knives of the surgeon? Or Schrodinger's puppets, wide-eyed in a coffin, dead but not dead, baptized in spite, waking to consciousness and slow decay. Now they lie in a crypt of glass. It would be a kindness to lower the lights.
You've been listening to Bogart and Banshee, a supernatural podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please leave a review, as it helps other people find us. Those cursed algorithms.